Today is Tuesday, November 24th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, how will a Joe Biden administration affect U.S. relations with Africa?
Obvious question you have to ask yourself is whether you liked the Obama administration's policies towards Africa. And if you did, you're probably going to find a lot to like about the Biden administration's policies towards Africa as well.
Also ahead, we look at COVID-19's deadly surge through the Midwestern United States.
The nurses at the Nebraska Medical Center are stretched to their limits.
Plus, controversy over French police treatment of migrants. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the U.S., where the official transition to a Joe Biden presidency is set to begin. Late Monday, President Donald Trump directed his team to cooperate with Biden's transition, despite having yet to concede the election. The move came after the Trump-appointed head of the U.S. General Services Administration, or GSA, Emily Murphy, said she ascertains that President-elect Joe Biden is the, quote, apparent winner, end quote, of the November 3rd election. That clears the way for Biden to coordinate with federal government agencies on plans for taking over on January 20th. To understand what this all means, I reached out to VOA White House senior correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Swara. Patsy, what does this GSA administrator's decision mean for the transition?
Well, this is what's called ascertainment. So this is a process, a peculiar process in the American political system, which means essentially that the GSA administrator says that, yes, Joe Biden is the winner of the election. And it means that the Biden-Harris transition team will have more than $6 million in taxpayer money, will be given a Washington office space, and more importantly, will be given access and coordination with other federal agencies in order to facilitate a smooth transition of power, which has always been the hallmark of American democracy.
Now, usually the GS administrator's confirmation of the election winner really isn't an issue. Why has it become so important this time around?
Yeah, it's usually a routine process, right? I mean, after a presidential election, usually somebody concedes, there's a concession speech, and then there's a victory speech, and then the GSA administrator declares the apparent winner, and the transition resources that we've spoken about, they just flow. So this time it is unusual because we do have a president who is still refusing to concede and a Republican Party that's standing by him. So what the GSA administrator does in this case may become president in the future. And that's why the administrator, Emily Murphy, really wanted more certainty with all the ongoing legal cases. And she only sent the letter Monday night after she was absolutely sure about the outcome.
And does this mean Trump has conceded or acknowledged that he lost?
The short answer is no. But in his tweet on Monday, the president did sort of, you know, inch closer to a concession, perhaps, saying that he was, quote, recommending that Emily, that's Emily Murphy, the GS administrator, recommending that Emily and her team do what needs to be done with regards to initial protocols and have told my team to do the same. So even his wording is, you know, perhaps deliberately vague. And we should note that there are still legal challenges going on, although the Trump campaign is running out of possible means of recourse. And we know that a total of 16 states so far have certified the results, and deadlines are coming early next month for, you know, other states, including the big ones, California, Texas, New York. And a couple of days to keep in mind here is also that all states must certify the results of the election before the Electoral College meets on December 14th, and any challenges to the results must be resolved by December 8th. So December 8th is an important date. December 14th is an important date. And by then, technically, everything should be resolved by then.
That's VOA Senior White House Correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Swara. Patsy, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
President-elect Biden has announced several of his picks for top U.S. diplomatic posts. He named his longtime close advisor and former Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken as his choice to be the next Secretary of State, which is the U.S. version of a foreign minister. Biden also named veteran diplomat Linda Thomas-Greenfield as his pick for U.N. ambassador. Thomas-Greenfield is an Africa specialist who served as Barack Obama's top diplomat for Africa. She also served as U.S. ambassador to Liberia and held posts in Kenya, the Gambia, and Nigeria. So if they are confirmed by the U.S. Senate, what will Biden's picks for top diplomatic positions mean for his administration's approach to Africa? To find out, I reached out to Professor Zachariah Mompili, who is the endowed chair of the Austin W. Marks School of Public and International Affairs at Baruch College at the City University of New York. Professor Mompili, thank you so much for joining us. Let's first talk about Linda Thomas-Greenfield. What might her appointment to the UN ambassador position mean for U.S. relations with Africa?
So I think the obvious question you have to ask yourself is whether you liked the Obama administration's policies towards Africa. And if you did, you're probably going to find a lot to like about the Biden administration's policies towards Africa as well. Thomas Greenfield is a longtime Africa hand, as it's referred to in Washington, D.C. Her entire career has been oriented around working in Africa. She was ambassador to a number of African countries and eventually rose to the position of Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs under the Obama administration. She has declared her interest in championing African issues going forward, and so it's likely that Africa will be important to the Biden administration, perhaps more so than under Obama. But I would point out that, you know, Obama also had some fairly prominent Africanists in his administration, like Susan Rice and Samantha Powers. So I'm not necessarily clear whether the appointment of Thomas Greenfield represents a break from the past or like I already said, more of what we saw under the Obama administration.
And how about Antony Blinken, who Biden has nominated for the Secretary of State position? How might he approach things compared to Trump's administration?
I think one way to think about it is a sort of competition between the isolationism that seemed to characterize the Trump administration, a desire to pull back America from its commitments abroad, to the type of American exceptionalism that was represented under both Obama and the Clinton administration, in which American diplomats really positioned the United States as a unique power in global affairs and the sort of maintainer of the international liberal order. I think what we see with Blinken and Thomas Greenfield is a desire to reassert the United States' position, presumed position in the global order, and likely a number of policies that look a lot like what we saw under earlier Democratic administrations. Specifically, you know, if you look at their public statements, both Blinken and Thomas Greenfield have talked a lot about the importance to expand trade ties to the African continent and to very much foreground the question of security and the war on terror. So I think those will likely be the dominant themes going forward.
Now, last of all, you know, there were many African observers who viewed Obama as a bit of a letdown for Africa compared to Bush, who was seen as someone who put Africa a bit higher on the agenda. So what does the return of many Obama-era officials mean?
I think in general, it's fair to say that the U.S. has had a high degree of disinterest in the African context, going back to the Obama administration. You know, as you already mentioned, the Bush administration actually received a lot of credit for its signature Africa program, the PEPFAR program, which sought to help African countries build their capacity to tackle the HIV/AIDS pandemic. If you look at the Obama administration's signature program, it was known as Power Africa. And I think by any objective measures, it has largely been considered a failure. And many of the people involved in the Biden administration were involved with the Power Africa program. So I think that we have seen that the United States has not prioritized Africa for much of the past two decades. Obviously, the continent has changed dramatically. There are a lot of new players on the scene. Most directly, China has certainly emerged as perhaps the most important partner for many African countries, and it doesn't seem, so far at least, based on any sort of public pronouncements from these figures, that we're likely to see a renewed push into Africa, and perhaps it's too late to do that anyways. I'm not expecting the U.S. to devote the kind of resources necessary to really pose a challenge to increased Chinese hegemony across Africa.
That's Professor Zachariah Mompili, who is the endowed chair of the Austin W. Marks School of Public and International Affairs at Baruch College at the City University of New York. Professor Mompili, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jason. I appreciate it.
Next, we go to France, where police broke up a protest camp of mostly Afghan and African migrants in central Paris Monday night. Journalist Catherine Field in Paris has that story.
Around 500 people gathered in the square at nightfall, put up small tents and started squatting in them before police moved in. The protest was by migrants who say they were left out of a program to house 3,000 people who'd been cleared last week from a major settlement outside Paris. Most of those 3,000 were from Sudan, Ethiopia, Somalia and Afghanistan. On social media, video footage has gone viral, purporting to show the police acting violently. Some tents were tipped over and the occupants tossed out. Others were carried off with people still inside. Police used tear gas to disperse the supporters. The police say they are simply enforcing the law, and this was an illegal occupation of a public space. But the Interior Minister says he was shocked by the confrontation and has asked the Police Investigation Unit to launch an immediate inquiry. The incident is part of a worrying backdrop for the French capital. In the last 5 years, there have been 66 clearances of makeshift encampments in Paris. There is also the context of tensions between Paris City Hall and the Interior Ministry. City Hall is demanding more resources from central government to deal with the migration influx. The government is taking a tough line, saying it can't provide endless shelter for migrants who come to Paris, and the real need is to stop the migration flow at source. Catherine Field for VOA News, Paris.
This is VOA. China said Tuesday it successfully launched a robotic spacecraft to bring back rocks from the moon. It's the first attempt by any country to retrieve lunar surface samples since the 1970s. The Long March 5, China's largest carrier rocket, blasted off at 4:30 a.m. Beijing time Monday in a launch from Wenchang Space Launch Center on the southern Chinese island of Hainan, carrying the Chang'e 5 spacecraft. The Chang'e 5 mission, named after the ancient Chinese goddess of the moon, will seek to collect lunar material to help scientists understand more about the moon's origins and formation. Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen on Tuesday vowed to defend the Democratic Island's sovereignty with the construction of a new fleet of domestically developed submarines, a key project supported by the United States to counter neighboring China. Taiwan, which China claims as its own territory, has been for years working to revamp its submarine force, some of which dates back to World War II and is no match for China's fleet, which includes vessels capable of launching nuclear weapons. The Trump administration on Monday issued a new temporary rule that could require tourist and business travelers from 24 countries, mostly in Africa, to pay a bond of as much as $15,000 to visit the United States. Countries whose tourist and business travelers could be subject to the bond's requirements include those from Democratic Republic of Congo, Liberia, Sudan, Chad, Angola, Burundi, Djibouti, and Eritrea. The rule takes effect December 24th and runs through June 24th, targeting countries whose nationals have higher rates of overstaying B2 visas for tourists and B1 visas for business travelers. The Trump administration said the six-month pilot program aims to test the feasibility of collecting such bonds and will serve as a diplomatic deterrent to overstaying visas. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. The COVID-19 outbreak in the U.S. continues to spread with an average of over 170,000 cases and over 1,500 deaths each day over the past week. The worst hit area is in the sparsely populated Central Plains region. In the state of Nebraska, there have been over 2,000 new infections per day over the last week. Nebraska houses the United States' only federal quarantine unit at the University of Nebraska, but it has been pushed to the brink with COVID-19 patients. Gloria So of Reuters reports.
The nurses at the Nebraska Medical Center are stretched to their limits.
Okay, I got it.
As COVID-19 patients push the hospital past its capacity.
Do you have what you need for pressors?
It's the United States' only federal quarantine unit, used during previous health crises like the Ebola outbreak in 2014. And it's designed to isolate and contain highly contagious diseases. However, the virus's grip on the Midwest has left the center's medical specialists struggling with cases double what they were in the spring and showing no sign of stopping. Dr. Mark Rupp is the center's chief of infectious diseases. He says they may soon have no choice but to selectively admit COVID-19 patients.
In Nebraska in particular, and within the upper Midwest in general, we're really just on fire. COVID is spreading very rapidly, person to person throughout the community, in a most alarming fashion.
For the past 2 weeks, thousands have been diagnosed with COVID-19 every day in Nebraska, a state with a population of only around 2 million. Rupp says Nebraska was not hard hit by the United States' first wave of the virus, and that too many Nebraskans may have thought they were safe from what they saw elsewhere on TV.
If they have their Thanksgiving gatherings and they continue to frequent bars and restaurants and gym facilities and pass this virus from person to person, then there's no reason that we can't become what New York looked like back in March.
But without a statewide mask mandate and with the Thanksgiving holiday just days away, Rupp fears the situation may only get worse. He's calling on all Americans to hold off on celebrating with family this year in the hopes of getting to see them again next year.
It's just not worth it. You know, it's unfortunately sort of our year with COVID. And I think what we need to hold out for folks is that next year at this time, I'm very hopeful that we will be able to have joyous family gatherings and holiday celebrations.
Thanks to Gloria So of Reuters for that report. Neighboring Nebraska is the state of South Dakota. Over the last week, South Dakota has averaged over 120 new COVID cases per day per 100,000 people, which is more than double the rate of the rest of the U.S. South Dakota also has one of the country's largest populations of indigenous Native American Indians, mainly from the Lakota tribe. To find out how the outbreak is affecting Native communities there, I reached out to Tatawin Means. Means is a member of the Oglala Lakota tribe and is the executive director of the Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. Tatawin, first of all, thank you for joining us. South Dakota has had one of the highest rates of COVID-19 infection on Earth. How is this impacting Native people there?
Yes, unfortunately, that is a statistic that we in Indian country are not proud of. Because it has such a direct impact on our vulnerable populations. So our elderly, our youngest relatives, you know, those that are just being born and in the early years of their lives are the most impacted. We also have, you know, tremendous health disparities in Lakota country, whether it's, you know, high rates of heart disease or cancer or diabetes. We have that extended vulnerable population that is drastically impacted by COVID-19 as well. And so the tribal nations here in South Dakota have worked diligently since the pandemic hit this land base to protect our populations. But when you're surrounded by state governments that are not as proactive and active in fighting the virus, then it has devastating effects.
You mentioned the neighboring state governments. Nebraska does not have a mask mandate. The governor of South Dakota, Kristi Noem, has been quite adamant that mask mandates or lockdowns or other public health measures are matters of individual freedom for each individual to decide rather than for governments to decide. Is that a view that's shared by tribal nations?
Definitely not. Like I mentioned, tribes were really quick to respond initially to protect populations, and, you know, requiring masks or face coverings were some of the early steps or early requirements that tribes put in place. And, you know, to some extent, I can understand this notion of individual responsibility. And because we at Thunder Valley CDC have a vision of liberation for our people, where ultimately it's, you know, a freedom to be responsible. But that only works if everyone has the same value system, the same value base. And unfortunately, in a place like South Dakota, where overt racism, blatant racism, and systemic racism are alive and well, we don't all have the same value system. So when you have Lakota communities and populations that are disproportionately affected by these types of decisions, it's not an equal playing field. And so it's easy to say that, oh, this is freedom where freedom lives. But when you have groups that have always been historically negatively affected by decisions of the colonizer, it's tremendously harmful.
So given this situation, what are Native people doing, whether your organization or others, to mitigate the effects of this pandemic?
Well, you know, and earlier you asked a question of how has this impacted our communities? And, you know, I did mention our elderly, but one of the most devastating impacts that we've seen across Lakota country is the loss of our fluent speakers in our elder populations. So, you know, our indigenous languages, our native languages are in danger of extinction. And so there have been language revitalization efforts that have been going, you know, for decades, trying to create first generation speakers again to save our languages. And, you know, the average age of fluent speakers is well over the age of 70 now. And, you know, the impacts of COVID is we're seeing a lot of loss in that area in our communities. And that's really, it's scary. And it's very real for us. It creates a sense of urgency on not one protecting this population, you know, all elders, but especially this language, you know, the fluent speaker population, and two, recording them, finding ways to safely, virtually or otherwise, record our elders so that we can capture those teachings. Because our language isn't just a language, it includes all of our teachings, our life ways, our spirituality. And so with the loss of language and language speakers, we lose pieces of who we are as Lakota people. And so, you know, we're organizing, we're having continual conversations around how can we support one another in protecting this population and preserving those teachings. So that's one way. Another way is creating, you know, massive networks of Indigenous response. So really supporting and uplifting each other in our local efforts. So whether that's getting food boxes to the elders across the reservation, you know, on Pine Ridge Reservation is over 2.5 million acres. And so it's a large land base that we cover, but making sure all of our elders, some without running water or electricity, how are we getting the needed supplies to them? And, you know, education, raising education and really promoting distancing, masks, you know, quarantining and isolating, you know, all of those recommended guidelines that are put forth by the CDC and other health organizations.
That's Tatawin Means, a member of the Oglala Lakota tribe. She is the executive director of the Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. Tatawin, thank you for joining us.
Pilamaya.
That's it for our show today. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A river is not merely a geographic feature. It is an essential, fundamental basis of human life, Assistant Secretary for East Asian and Pacific Affairs David Stilwell noted in opening remarks at the recent inaugural Indo-Pacific Conference on Strengthening Governance of Transboundary Rivers. And the people of the Mekong particularly know this truth, he said, because they are living with the terrible consequences of upper riparian water control, with increasing and devastating impact on the lives of tens of millions for whom the Mekong represents life itself. The East-West Center, in partnership with the U.S. Department of State and the Mekong-U.S. Partnership, hosted the virtual conference on October 15, 2020, convening policymakers, academics, members of civil society, and other transboundary river stakeholders from across the Indo-Pacific region to share best practices related to the sustainable development and cooperative management of transboundary rivers. Assistant Secretary Stilwell highlighted the new Mekong-U.S. partnership and its role in expanding U.S. engagement with the five countries of the Mekong subregion. He underscored the United States' commitment to the Mekong region, as evidenced by the $3.9 billion the United States provided in the region since 2009, as well as our enduring support to the Mekong River Commission, or MRC, and transparent transboundary river governance. Assistant Secretary Stilwell also raised U.S. concerns over China's unilateral manipulation of Mekong River flows and the need for comprehensive year-round water data sharing through the MRC. In closing remarks, U.S. Ambassador to Thailand Michael DeSombre said, "Success in the Mekong region will depend not only on strong institutions and partnerships, but on transparent flow of data as well. That is why the United States created the Mekong Water Data Initiative with input from more than 60 government and NGO partners to improve data sharing and science-based decision-making." The MekongWater.org platform platform, announced by Secretary Pompeo last year, includes more than 40 tools covering everything from weather forecasting to citizen science. He said the U.S. plans to unveil a major upgrade to this platform in coming weeks. The United States, along with its friends and allies from across the globe, is committed to continued partnership with Mekong region countries to build a prosperous, sustainable